From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. I was a pudgy preteen during a time that diet drugs were gaining traction. That meant I followed my mom into a world of Metrical, Dexatrim, and the dieting candy AIDS. My body ended up shedding that weight without my help, but that fat mind as a torturer never left. I look back at photos of me and I want to cry for that child who was doomed to a life of failed Weight Watcher attempts and self-loathing. At a time when the CDC is actually advocating bariatric surgery for children, we need a conversation around body size and our value as people, and particularly how we adults lead children through the heinous maze of diet culture. Virginia Soul Smith is the author of Fat Talk, Parenting in the Age of Diet Culture. Hi, Virginia. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for having me.
How early do children start to look at their bodies with a critical eye informed by others and the media?
It's so early. I mean, it's exactly, you know, what you just shared about your experiences. Research shows that between the ages of 3 and 5, children are learning to equate the word fat with all sorts of negative traits. And by elementary school, they're starting to be more concretely anxious about their own bodies. And, you know, I think this really shocks parents because we think, often I hear from parents like, well, I don't know how to talk about this because I don't want to give her something to worry about. But the truth is they're absorbing this from everything around them, and even from really well-intended things. Like if they say, you know, if your toddler in the grocery store points out a fat lady and says, "Mama, look at her fat tummy," parents rush in and say, "Don't say fat, don't say fat, that's not nice." And then right away, even though you're trying to sort of ease them through an awkward moment, you're also telling them that fat is not an okay way to be.
You say that because we've tangled health, beauty, and morality all together, preventing or reversing fatness has become our culture's passion project, our spiritual calling, and our most popular national pastime. How true and how awful.
Yeah.
You also say that this leads parents to experience fat phobia as a kind of terror. Can you expand on that?
Sure. So, you know, anti-fat bias is this set of preconceived notions we have, the judgments we make when we see someone in a bigger body, and we think we understand their eating habits, their lifestyle habits, their work ethic. I mean, all these negative connotations we associate with fat. And, you know, none of that is necessarily true about a fat person any more than it's true about any other person. These are stereotypes. This is bias. But it brings with it a ton of judgment and a ton of really negative consequences. I mean, our culture does treat fat people worse than thin people. We know that fat people earn less money at jobs, they're less likely to get hired, less likely to get promoted, they have a harder time accessing healthcare is a huge issue. Even, you know, access to public spaces and the ability to buy clothes in their size, all of that can be so much more fraught. And so for parents, there is a fear because we don't necessarily want our kids to experience that. If we grew up fat ourselves, we know about the bullying that can happen. We know about the stigmatization, and we want to protect our kids from that. We also want to protect ourselves because parents face a tremendous amount of judgment if they're the parent of a child in a bigger body, especially if they're in a bigger body themselves. But the problem is, because of the way the culture has taught us to think about fatness, we then zero in on trying to prevent or change fatness. We try to control the child's weight. We try to control our own weight instead of saying, hang on, this whole system is wrong. We want to work on making the world safer for our children's bodies and our own bodies.
You know, we talk so much about food on this show. I mean, that's what this show is about. It's about food. And there mm-hmm. is definitely a slant of food, a way of eating that can be seen as virtue signaling.
Mm-hmm.
The kind of virtue signaling that you say we see staying thin, especially if you do it via a plant-based, locally sourced whole foods diet, as the same kind of virtuous, socially responsible act as limiting your child's screen time or saving for college.
Mm-hmm.
It just complicates everything.
It really does. And it's because we've got thinness tangled in there where it doesn't need to be. If we were just talking about nutrition in the sense of how do we raise kids who feel confident around trying different foods? How do we raise kids who can experience joy in foods and also understand how different foods feel in their bodies? That would all be fine, right? That would be a pretty unbiased way to engage with food. And you could then decide for yourself, like, I feel good when I eat salad some days, but some days I really do want the cheeseburger. Or, you know, you could interact with food in this very not fraught way. But because the pursuit of thinness is embedded into how we think about nutrition, when parents are thinking about how to feed their kids, they have all this added pressure because they're thinking, if I get this wrong, I'm going to end up with a fat child and that's going to be so terrible. And, you know, that's going to lead to all these consequences we just talked about. And so this is what leads us down a really dangerous path, because we know for kids in all body sizes, the number one predictor of future eating disorder risk is experiences of weight-based shame or teasing and childhood dieting. And a really restrictive approach to how you feed your kids can amount to both those things.
The book is so amazing. Who did you talk to for the book? You talked to experts, but who else did you talk to?
Yeah. So I did a lot of interviews with researchers of all stripes, obesity researchers, weight stigma researchers, nutrition folks, pediatricians, you know, that's the kind of quote expert column. But the people I really wanted to hear from, and in fact, the way I started every chapter before I would do those expert interviews, was real families, real parents and kids who are navigating this, whether it's they have a child with an eating disorder, a parent with an eating disorder, a child in a bigger body, sometimes with an eating disorder, you know, the sort of whole range of experiences. And I really tried to include as much diversity as I can in terms of, you know, race and ethnicity, gender identities, et cetera, so that we're really getting a sense. Because too often, when we hear about eating disorders, we automatically picture a thin white teenage girl. And then when we hear about the, quote, childhood obesity crisis, we automatically picture a fat kid and probably a brown or black kid. And I wanted to help us sort of collapse these things, because one of the biggest problems we have here is all of the rhetoric on the, quote, war on childhood obesity has led us to be okay with eating disordered behaviors from kids in bigger bodies. We are like, well, they're on the right track. We want them to lose weight. So the same things that would be a red flag in a thin white teenage girl, it's fine if it's a 10-year-old boy doing it, you know, in a bigger body. And that's really terrible and really dangerous to kids' health.
Can you talk a little bit more about fatness in its intersectionality?
Sure. So anti-fat bias is really rooted in specifically anti-Black racism in this country. So when we trace it back, we look at the rise of modern diet culture and when the thin ideal, I mean, throughout history, we've had rigid body ideals. Every culture in the world has had rigid body ideals. That's not new. But in the United States, at the end of slavery, at the end of the 19th century, we see media representations of ideal bodies getting much thinner. And we also see the medical community starting to praise thinness and demonize fatness in the literature. And the other thing that's happening at that same time is, of course, this massive culture shift where Black people were no longer enslaved. The white people in power are trying to preserve the social hierarchy. So it makes sense that you would start to really idealize this thin, and specifically a thin white body, in order to demonize and other larger Black and brown bodies. And so it's really useful to understand our current body ideals is really coming from that. And what that also means is all of our understanding about weight and health is rooted in that same bias. The bias predates the current research on obesity. So all of the sort of scientific understandings we've been grappling with over the last 40 years, were all that research was conducted from a place of fatness is bad, fat bodies are bad, and not all that bias. And that does really impact how the science is getting done and what questions aren't getting asked.
Let's talk about puberty.
Sure.
I found that chapter in your book so fascinating, and it really spoke to me personally. I mean, that's when my diet trouble began. I was so early when I got my period and I started to develop. But it seems that puberty is coming even earlier than ever, at least for girls, and often does so regularly for Black girls. Could you talk a bit about that and if this situation affects girls more than boys?
Yeah, it does seem to affect girls more than boys, or girls and gender nonconforming kids, I should say, because of the way we have conflated anti-fatness and anti-blackness and misogyny, right? It's all intersecting here. So as girls start puberty and begin to develop, it is biologically necessary for them to put on a significant amount of body fat. You cannot start menstruating if you don't have adequate body fat. So girls often have this really rapid growth spurt starting age 9, 10, 11, and lots of kids look like they're getting rounder rather than getting, you know, just overall bigger. And so this is often a moment when parents and pediatricians really freak out. I cannot tell you how many people I've interviewed who say their eating disorder struggles started at their 10-year-old well visit checkup at the pediatrician, when the doctor grabbed their belly or made a comment about cutting out junk food or switching to skim milk or just something that completely reduced the child to their body size and made them feel like, oh my gosh, my body is this huge problem to solve. And so we're really alienating kids from their bodies at this time when, you know, puberty is fraught and challenging in so many ways. The last thing we need to do is make kids feel like they're more at war with their body during that time. We should instead be really normalizing the fact that bodies change, but you are still you, that, you know, throughout your life, puberty is this big set of changes, but there may also be pregnancy, there may also be injury or disability, there may be aging. Like, you know, we're all going to change if we get to keep living. So we should really be embracing the idea that bodies change.
Yeah, you talk very powerfully about why we should expect that children start to take up more space physically and metaphorically as they go through puberty. I mean, even down to the fact that our organs grow.
Right. I think just helping kids understand the really absolute magic that is happening in their bodies at that stage. But it's because we're really uncomfortable with the idea that people we want to think of as little girls are starting to look like women. And this, we especially see this stigma being weaponized against Black girls who, there's lots of research showing they get sexualized much younger, they get accused of bad behavior, white peers get away with much more. They're adultified because of their bodies. And so what we really need to do is change our understanding of what a quote little girl looks like and understand that a 10-year-old may be in a bra and they're still a 10-year-old and they still deserve all the support and care that you would give any 10-year-old. They are not an adult. They are not ready to take on all of that.
Yeah, it's good to remember that cognitive development isn't in step with early reproductive development.
Absolutely not. Yeah.
How has the punitive measuring stick of BMI made all of this more complicated?
So BMI is really, to be honest with you, a trash measurement for health, especially for children. It doesn't take into account puberty development stages. So, you know, when you see kids developing earlier than their peers, they're going to be ranked higher on the BMI chart, but they're just on a different point of their growth trajectory. It's not anything to pathologize. And what the BMI chart really does, because the first thing we do at a doctor's visit, and this is true for adults too, is we all get on the scale and then we get classified on that BMI chart, the doctor immediately walks in and interacts with us as a BMI number instead of as a whole person. And we've seen this really lead to, you know, folks with higher BMIs are more likely to be turned away from certain medical procedures. They're less likely to get referred for testing. The entire conversation the doctor wants to have is about weight loss, weight loss, weight loss. And meanwhile, you came in for knee pain or, you know, a sinus infection or something that really you need actual intervention on. And they want you to go away and lose 50 pounds before you actually seek treatment. So fat folks are more likely to doctor shop because they experience such stigmatizing care. They're more likely to put off going to the doctor. I heard from lots of people who, after that appointment where the doctor says the stigmatizing thing, just try to not go for several years. And of course, when you're avoiding preventive health care, that can take a toll on your health because you're sicker by the time you finally get there. So it's a really critical piece of it. We think of BMI as this barometer of health, but it's actually become an enormous barrier to accessing health care for way too many people.
Have you done any research or spoken to parents in the course of your work beyond this book, this particular book, about the way in which getting children involved in preparing food can also mitigate negative feelings.
That's really interesting. I have done some reporting around that, and I think there's a couple ways to think about it. I mean, if you're thinking, I want to get my child involved in cooking food with me because I want them to eat vegetables, and underpinning that I want them to eat vegetables is because I don't want them eating junk food, because I want them to be thin, I think it's going to be no more useful than any other strategy, because when that underlying goal is thinness, we end up in the same place that we're talking about. But I think if you're thinking about it as a way to help a cautious eater expand their palate on their own terms, if you're thinking about it as a way to just bond with your kid because you get a lot of joy out of preparing food and it's something you can do with them, that's a totally different conversation. I think that can make food a really joyful place. And that's fundamentally what we want our kids to experience around food, is connection and love, and understand food as a way to be in community, right? So cooking together can be wonderful. But I do think there's often some unrealistic expectations and standards around this. I remember, this is a little bit of a tangent, but I remember interviewing an expert on screen time for a parenting piece I was writing several years ago, and he was really strict about no screen time, like minimal screen time for kids. And I was like, well, what am I supposed to do while I'm cooking dinner on a Wednesday night with my two-year-old, because I got to get dinner on the table, and letting her watch TV is like how I'm achieving this goal. He was like, well, have her cook with you. Give her a bag of flour. Let her make a giant mess in the kitchen. And I was just thinking, that's fine on like a rainy Saturday when we don't have anywhere to be. But like when I'm doing the weeknight dinner rush and we've got bedtime and we're all stressed out, the last thing I need to feel like a good mom is like I let my kid make a huge mess with a bag of flour. So I think it's a lot of things here, right? It can be wonderful. It can be connection. It can also be added pressure and be sort of unrealistic for the needs of your family on any given night. And letting people just make their own calls about that feels really important to me.
Thank you so much, Virginia.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I appreciate your work so much.
Thank you. That means so much.
That was Virginia Soul Smith, author of Fat Talk, Parenting in the Age of Diet Culture. She produces the newsletter and podcast Burnt Toast, where she explores fat phobia, diet culture, parenting, and health. Coming up, the food of Sri Lanka is irresistible. It's all about hoppers and curry next.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food. At the age of 28, Karan Gokhani made a major pivot. He gave up his career as a Cambridge-trained lawyer and decided to go into the restaurant business. Karan grew up in a Gujarati household in Mumbai, but his passion for Sri Lankan and South Indian food had become an obsession. And in 2015, he opened Hoppers with his wife and brother-in-law in London's Soho neighborhood. The restaurant was an immediate success and spawned his recent book, Hoppers, the cookbook. Hi.
Hi, Evan. I'm so excited to be here, both in the US and on your show.
Yeah. I mean, you must be having a lot of fun on this tour. So what are influences that have shaped the food of Sri Lanka?
So when I first went there, I was expecting food that's very similar to South India, particularly Tamil Nadu. But I was very amazed because the food in northern Sri Lanka, as you'd expect, does have that influence in regions like Jaffna. But as you travel south, although this is a tiny little teardrop-shaped island, it's had years of colonization. So you've got a great Dutch influence in the food, and that's known as the burger food, B-U-R-G-H-E-R, nothing to do with hamburgers. But they've got dishes like lamb rice. They've got amazing desserts like the love cake, which I'm obsessed with. And it's such a different genre of food from the northern Jaffna Tamil-influenced food. And then you have the Sinhalese food, which is quite omnipresent across the island. That tends to be almost like a hybrid between the South Indian flavors that I've grown up eating, coconut, mustard seeds, fenugreek seeds, curry leaves. But then you've got the East Asian influences from places like Malaysia and Thailand and China. So you've got pandan leaves, which come in, and I've never seen pandan leaves used in Indian cuisine. Lemongrass, which is amazing. And it's not just in desserts, but it gives this lovely aromatic hint to curries like the traditional red chicken curry. And then you've got the Moor food or the Malay food, which is more of the Muslim community. So biryanis, which are very different from India. You've got incredible curries and the meatier dishes. I mean, I could go on.
But if you were to pick, one dish that you feel is sort of the marquee dish for mm-hmm. introducing people to these flavors that are such a melange that you're talking mm-hmm. about, what would it be?
For me, it would have to be the black pork curry. So this is a curry that I first ate at a little cafe in Colombo and then spent the best part of the next 3 years trying to reverse engineer it. And then finally came upon, you know, we finally developed this recipe that we love and we use at the restaurant and then kind of redeveloped that for the book. So it's this incredible curry made with a kalupol powder, which is effectively toasted coconut and rice along with some chili. So you toast the three of these ingredients till they almost get to a coffee-like dark color, but just on the verge of burn. So you don't have the acrid burnt flavors, but you've got a very strong toasty flavor. You then grind it. And then you obviously use various other aromats and onion and garlic and ginger and all that kind of stuff. And then you cook pork belly in it. So you've got the fattiness of the pork, which is cut by this toasty, this curry powder. And it's a curry like I've never had before. So it is still very much rooted in that region of the world. And it's a curry that, you know has come from there. But for me, it's like nothing I've ever tried in South India before. So for me, that was a revelation. And it even till today defines my first experience of Sri Lanka. So it's got to be the black pork curry.
The book is beautiful and it's called Hoppers and your restaurant is called Hoppers. And you've already referenced them once in our conversation. Yes. So describe what they are and how they're different from other kinds of breads that might accompany curries that we see in Southern India.
Mm-hmm. So as you'd expect in Southern India, there's a lot more rice in the diet. There's a lot less wheat. Now wheat has found its way. So most of the traditional breads were made from rice or rice and lentils. The hopper is made from, so you soak this special short grain rice along with some coconut, and then you grind it, and then you ferment the batter. So you can ferment it with various things, with coconut water, with toddy, or with yeast, dried or fresh yeast. So we do it with yeast in the restaurant. And it's almost like a sourdough. So you have to wait for it to get to the right consistency where there's the right level of sweetness, there's the right level of fermentation, the bubbles. And then you take a ladle of this thick batter, you pour it into an aluminium wok, which is the best way to make a hopper. You could use nonstick, but we always prefer the aluminium wok, which is heated over gas. You can't do this on induction, sadly. And then imagine adding a ladle full of batter into this hot wok, giving it a quick swirl, and then allowing the batter to pool in the middle. So you've got a little pool of batter at the bottom, and you've got a really thin lace around the top. So effectively what you get after it cooks for a few minutes is a crisp bowl-shaped pancake that's got that lovely fermented background note, but it's got coconut, it's got rice, it's pillowy and soft in the middle, crisp on the edges. You can crack an egg into the middle and steam it, and that makes an egg hopper. I love adding some coconut milk and jaggery, which gives you this amazing treacle-like, savory, sweet hopper. It's my favorite thing in the world. I eat it for breakfast, I eat it with curries, I eat it on its own. And then think of this bowl, which you just rip and dip into your curries, into your sambals, just eat as is. It's incredible.
Sri Lanka is an island, so one imagines that seafood figures heavily. Mm-hmm. Can you pick a seafood recipe that you would love us to make from the book?
Absolutely. The crab curry, all the way the crab curry. You know, we would have, and we still do every time I go back, the one meal that's non-negotiable is at my friend Rishini's house. Her mother, Sharika, is the one who taught me how to cook Sri Lankan food. And we have this massive crab feast. So all that we have is bol sambal, which is a coconut relish. fresh roast bon bought from a little street vendor, but there is a recipe in a book. It's a beautiful white bread and just copious amounts of crab curry in the middle of the table. We get newspaper on the table. All of us get in there in shorts, t-shirts, we're ready to sacrifice. And then just reach out, get large chunks of lagoon crab, which is the equivalent of the sort of Dungeness crab here. Really meaty, really delicious. And just get stuck right in. So dipping the bread into the curry, splatters of crab all over the place. You've got to be sitting with good friends because there's often times when there's flecks flying all over the place. So we avoid it at the restaurant unless it's a special event because our tables are all quite small. So we do a swimmer crab, which is easier to eat and navigate. But I think the chunky big brown crab, the Dungeness crab, would make for incredible crab curries.
So, you know, we're all pretty familiar with chutneys and many Indian pickles, but you talk about sambals and malungs,
yes,
which you describe as somewhere between a salad and a relish. So describe what they are, how they're used in the context of a meal, and which one we should start with.
Sambals, I think, definitely have, they have a connect to East Asia or sort of Malaysia, where you have sambals. In Sri Lanka, you spell them sambols, so S-A-M-B-O-L-S. And these are often just colorful condiments to your meal, but very often you could have just a hopper and one of these sambols. Now, the most basic of them is just onions, red chili flakes, salt, and lime, which is also delicious if it's done with the right ingredients. If you have the right chili and the right onion, you pound it together in a pestle and mortar, they just come together beautifully, and you have the citrus balancing it, and all you need is dip that egg hopper in there. That's a lunumeris. You could then add a little bit of moldy fish. So very often when I pronounce it, people think I'm talking about moldy fish, but it's not moldy. It's fish from the Maldives.
Is it a fermented or a cured fish?
It's a dried fish. So it's exactly the same as katsuobushi in Japanese food, the bonito fish.
Mm.
So there you have those dancing flakes, or you have the powder, which is used in the stocks and broths for, you know, tons and tons of umami. But in Sri Lankan food, you either get them in big chunks, so they're dried or often smoked fish, but just hard chunks on the streets. Or if you were to buy them in retail stores, you get them in little flecks. So they'll be broken up into little chips, they call them. But I often just grind them a little bit or break them down a little more and then add them to these sambals. So you've got this, it should not taste of fish. So like when you're cooking Thai food or Vietnamese food and you add fish sauce to it, it adds an amazing background note and an umami, but you should never taste it individually, and it just takes it to the next level. Now, you could add one more ingredient, grated fresh coconut, and now you're talking, you know, incredible Sri Lankan sambals. Now, often to that, we add in some greens or some vegetables. Again, it's endless. So people have different styles of sambals at home. But for me, those were the main ones. In the uncooked category, and just as I started sort of defining this category as a category of relishes that are just mixed in a pestle and mortar, there came along Sini Sambal, which is this onion relish. So it's almost like caramelized onions with chili and pandan leaf and cinnamon, and then this moldy fish in the background, which is unbelievable. Imagine like onion jam, which is just next level.
I mean, that sounds extraordinary with the pandan leaves.
Pandan leaves are just such a great savory ingredient. So they add that background note, which is very hard to replace. But, you know, people often ask me, that's the one question I get a lot in the book. Like, if we can't get pandan leaves, what do we do? You could leave it out, or you could get the dried leaves. So dried leaves are easier to source. Or if you can find the fresh leaves, which are, you know, very easy to find in Asian grocery stores, Chinese grocery stores, get them and freeze them, because they are fantastic.
This has been such a pleasure getting to spend time with you. Thank you so much.
I've loved it.
That was Karan Gokhani, one of the founders of Hoppers, a trio of Sri Lankan and South Indian restaurants in London. He also wrote Hoppers the Cookbook. We've got a recipe for Hoppers along with that delicious Sini Sambal on our website. You know the link, kcrw.com/goodfood. In a minute, until it was drained for agricultural purposes, Tulare Lake in California's Central Valley was once the dominant feature on California's map, sprawling out across 800 square miles. After this year's epic rain and snowfall, the lake is back, ushering in a new chapter in California's water wars. We've got the drama and the lore next. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. Water is power, and nowhere more so than in California's Central Valley, which produces 250 crops valued at $17 billion. Journalist Mark Arox returns to discuss the current lay of the land, literally. Hi, Mark.
Hello. Good. Really good to be with you, Evan.
Oh, it's just always so great to have you back to talk about this stuff. There are so many different ways of discussing water in California. So let's focus on Corcoran. Where is the Corcoran Bowl and how much area does it cover?
So you're talking about a place called the Tulare Lake Basin, and it is in the southern end of the San Joaquin Valley, which is connected to the Sacramento Valley, which makes the Great Central Valley. So we're talking about one of the great valleys in the world, and as you said, probably the most prolific producer of agricultural crops, certainly in the nation and perhaps in the world as well. So down in the southern end, the Tulare Lake Basin was defined by Tulare Lake, which was a lake that went back probably 8,000-10,000 years, or, you know, or at least 1,000. And it was a lake of the indigenous tribes here, the Yokuts. And it was the most dominant feature on the California map. At its height, it was about 800 square miles, way bigger than Lake Tahoe, the biggest body of fresh water west of the Mississippi. And the Yokuts fished along its shore. It was a shallow lake. The women were able to fish mussels with their toes just by walking the bottom. The men had these tule rafts, these rafts made of bulrushes, and they would have holes in them, and they'd spear fish. So this was the terminus for four rivers that came out of the Sierra and ran across the middle of California. These rivers did not connect and go out to the Pacific Ocean. Their endpoint was Tulare Lake. And at some point after the gold rush, those miners became farmers, and others came here, and they started claiming the flow of the rivers, diverting those rivers away from the lake, and it started to dry up. And then when the dams went in the 1940s, it dried up for good. But every so often, in a heavy snowmelt and rain year, in spite of all the contrivances of man, dams, ditches, levees, canals, pumps that make the rivers run backward, in spite of all that, the water comes back and fills up Tulare Lake. And that is what's happened this winter and spring.
So to give us an idea of how full it is and how much landmass it's taking up again and how intrusive its presence is, give us an idea of all that.
So it's nowhere near the Lake of Lore, okay? It's about 100 square miles, and it's growing because the biggest snow melt is just coming down now. We had a fairly mild spring, but now we're getting in the 90s and the hundreds here. And with those temperatures, the snow melt's going to come all at once, and no one knows how big the lake's going to get. But speculation is, and science kind of shows, that the lake will come back in a bigger fashion than it did in 1997, in a bigger fashion than it did in 1983 and 1969. So this may be the lake at a height that we haven't seen in a century and a half.
So let's talk for a minute about the other thing that Corcoran is really famous for, and that is the subsidence.
Yes.
Describe subsidence and how it's affected this town and this area.
So let me give just a tad bit of history that'll lead right to that. In 1920, these farmers from the South, led by Colonel J.G. Boswell, they were plantation owners, slave owners. They came west. He came west, J.G. Boswell, because he was working for Goodyear Tire, and tires had cotton in them. And he decided that he just didn't want to broker cotton. He wanted to grow it. So he started growing it in the Tulare Lake bottom. They took control of 15% of the Kings River and was able to use that in dry years and then try to keep it away in flood years. So this became one of the most engineered landscapes in all of America. I mean, they flattened it. They dewatered the lake, and the Army Corps declared the lake bottom a flood zone, as crazy as that sounds. And so they planted cotton and cotton and cotton, and then later on tomatoes and other things, but it was always annual crops. Well, the new farmers here, wanting to extract even more out of this land, have now planted permanent crops, almonds, pistachios, and if you can believe it, mega dairies are actually down on the lake bottom. And this has brought a whole new level, a whole new magnitude of kind of industrial agriculture. So in other words, they not only dried the lake and took the flow of its rivers, but now because of the industrialization further of this land, they're now going to the lake beneath the ground and sucking that dry with these pumps and wells that reach 2,000, 2,500 feet into the ground. I mean, these are many Empire State Buildings on top of each other. And they're pumping from the depths below the Corcoran clay. And as they're pumping out the water and the land is sinking. As the clay sinks, the land sinks with it. And so you have subsidence that's 10, 15 feet. And obviously this is imperiling the whole infrastructure down there, the levees that protect the towns. The water is now moving in a way that it didn't move in past floods, all because the geology, the topography has been altered by extraction.
Are there any legal measures? Have there been any government oversight to reduce the pumping of groundwater?
The state of California has something called SGMA, the Sustainable Groundwater Act. And it's supposed to basically limit this kind of pumping. But when they passed it, it had such a long run-up, 25 years. The state should have probably come in and told Boswell to stop pumping from those depths. And they haven't. And so, no, this is kind of a no-man's land down there. These big farmers have run it as their own domain for a century and more.
What other companies besides Boswell are really large drawers of the water?
Boswell is the principal one. I mean, they bought out their chief rival, the Salyers, you know, about 25 years ago. You have some other longtime farmers, the Gilkeys, the Hansons, but they're kind of victims of what's happened here. They're getting flooded out, and Boswell has stayed dry enough to plant a whole tomato crop. Now, whether that or not that crop survives the rest of this snow melt, it's anyone's guess. And then you have in that lake bottom and around it, you have these hedge funds and pension funds from all over the country coming there. I mean, John Hancock has planted pistachios in and around there. It's a free-for-all down there when it comes to pumping and water. And, you know, this is a flood year, but we just come through essentially 10 years of historic drought.
So when, you know, when regular people who don't know a lot about water in California hear about a drought cycle, and then they see all this rain and they see the huge amount of snow in the Sierras and they read the stories about the snowmelt, a lot of people think, well, great, it's just going to seep into the ground and it will replenish all of these underground lakes, these aquifers. Is that what's going to happen?
It will. I mean, we count on flood years to recharge that aquifer. The problem is, as subsidence happens, it collapses the land, and its ability to soak, like sponge, soak up that water is lost. We just can't recharge the aquifer the way we used to. But you'd have to have successive flood years to make up for the deficit that we now have. We've been over pumping for a century, and that water that used to be within 5-10 feet of the surface is now hundreds of feet below.
Will there be some farmers in the area who will basically have to give up their land to water for the foreseeable future. They won't be able to plant anymore, that the lake will have just taken up residence once again?
Yes. You're looking at a couple years probably before it fully dries out. But they have these pumps that are able to move water to these cells of land outside the basin, and they can move it. They're very efficient at moving. And then, you know, there's crop insurance and things like that. So what we have here is something very fascinating. We have the descendants of the Yokuts and other indigenous are kind of rooting for this lake to come back, and it has. And then you have these communities on the periphery, some of them people of color, who are caught between. They're part of them is rooting for the lake to come back. They love to see nature trump all this this industrial agriculture, but at the same time, they worry about their communities. And then you have farmers down there who are fighting like hell to keep water off. So this is one of the great dramas of California. You know, you have a piece of history coming back, a ghost, a phantom, we've called it. But really, the lake has never lost its memory for that place. It knows where to land.
Do you think that there's going to be ripple effects that will be felt in the nation's food supply?
I don't think so. There's a lot of cotton down there. Now, you know, we do produce some, you know, quite a bit of the nation's tomatoes, but cotton already is a surplus crop. So no, I don't see it affecting that so much. I think farm workers are affected down there, although this is a highly industrialized kind of agriculture. It doesn't employ a lot of pickers and packers.
I really hope the community water of these towns isn't affected.
Well, what they're talking about now is that maybe we ought to retire some of this lake bottom and let the water find itself. And that way it takes flood pressure off of other places. So you retire the land and then you just allow those waters to come in the heavy snowmelt years, and you return it to something of what it was. You know, we've allowed the Sacramento River to find some of its old flood plain. It's made sense. It's been healthier for fish. And maybe there's an argument to be made, I think a strong argument, that Tulare Lake, at least a part of it, ought to come back.
As always, Mark, it's always a pleasure to talk to you about these things. Thank you so much for coming.
Thanks for letting me go on and on, Evan. I really appreciate it.
That's award-winning journalist and California Native son, Mark Arax. We've been discussing the current state of water affairs in the Central Valley. Mark's book, The Dreamt Land, Chasing Water and Dust Across California, is just an amazing read. It's now available in paperback. Katie Nuchlaor and Amanda Manisi Lawson came to the United States from Thailand with their parents when they were children. When their parents opened Chow Krung in the 1970s, it was only the second Thai restaurant to open in that swath of East Hollywood now known as Thai Town. The family built a legacy that includes Chow Krung, Tuk Tuk, Same Same, and a handful of other restaurants. Katie shares her family's story in this week's In the Weeds.
I'm Katie Nuchlaor, owner-operator of Chow Krung Thai, Tuk Tuk Thai, and Same Same Thai. Our parents migrated from Thailand to Los Angeles in the 1970. They came from Bangkok, and they opened Chow Krung as one of the first Thai restaurants, which is now known as Los Angeles Thai Town. I came here when I was 8 years old, and Amanda came over when she was 9 years old, a year after me. My parents had never been in the restaurant business. My mom and aunt experience from cooking actually came from our grandmother. Our grandmother cooked in the royal palace, so they were trained their skills and craft from our grandmother and learned the culinary way of Thai cooking. So when they came to United States, they take that experience, and because they're also missing home and Thai food, they open a restaurant. the first location opened in Hollywood, they actually did the exact recipe that they learned from our grandmother. At the time, back in the days, not all ingredients were available, but they were able to make their own curry paste from scratch, you know, by getting some fresh herbs from their garden. You know, they have basil planted, they have kefir, lime leaf planted, the basic ingredients. So they were able to form a recipe and start their cooking from scratch. It was not known to the general public. It was more, our demographic was more Thai customers, and we weren't reviewed by any local newspaper at all. It's all word of mouth. So the restaurant was busy with Thai customers until they opened the second location, which is the current location now, which is on Fairfax, right across from the Grove. That location, they find it a lot tougher to continue with the same menu as the first location. So they adapted the menu a little bit. Our parents have to bring on Chinese-influenced dishes because Chinese food is well known. So they would add on like a xiao min to a menu, egg foo yang, certain fried rice dishes, egg rolls, wonton soup, anything to get customer to walk in the door. And then they slowly introduce the familiar dishes like the pad thai, the curries, and the stir fry. We both took over our parents' restaurant in 2017 because, you know, they are retiring. And they were ready. They were ready to move to Thailand and wanted us to take over and refresh the restaurant. Our approach on recreating Chow Kung is to focus on preserving the complexity of the culinary Thai style of cooking. So what our menu was carrying then, we shift our focus and bringing back the original menu that started Chow Kung in Hollywood. Because this past few years, Thai restaurant has, Thai food has gained popularity and it's more familiar with the customers. We want to bring back the authentic menu that was created by my mom and aunt when they first opened the restaurant. All of the Chinese dishes was taken away. What we brought back is the fish cakes, beef jerky, also the catfish, the Hung Lei curry was actually a new dish created by Amanda. Also, besides the menu that created by my mom and my aunt, Amanda also put her own dishes in the menu as well.
That was Katie Neuchlauer. Together with her sister Amanda Manisi Lawson, she runs the Thai restaurants Chow Krung on Fairfax and Tuk Tuk in West LA. Katie also runs Same Same Thai, a wine bar and Thai restaurant in Silver Lake. Head to kcrw.com/goodfood for links to all of them. Stone fruit season is officially in full swing. Find out what's coming into season this week in Southern California on the Market Report. That's next. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. It is unofficially summer in Southern California, which means that fruit continues to shine at the market. Let's head to Santa Monica now to find out what's at its peak this week in Southern California.
This is Jillian Ferguson with the Market Report. We have entered the blink and you miss it part of fruit season. Some of our favorite stone fruit varieties show up for just 1 or 2 weeks. And one of these early varieties is the Flavorella. It's a plumcot grown in Reedley, California by farmer Bob Wiebe. Hi, Bob.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. So the Flavorella is a plumcot. What is that and how does it differ from a pluot?
Pluot is more plum than apricot, and this is kind of a 50-50 blend.
Okay, and where does this one come from? Is there an origin story to the Flavorella?
Yes, this one comes from a company owned by Floyd Zager, and he was a prolific plant breeder out of Modesto area, and they have bred a lot of the tree fruit and other things that we eat today.
And I don't see this particular variety at a lot of other stands. How many farmers do you know who are growing it?
I only really knew one or two others that have grown it. It's a little difficult, and it can be blink and it's on the ground kind of thing. But it can be a little stubborn, but it eats really well.
Oh, it's so beautiful. The chefs love it too. So describe what it looks like and what the flavor is.
Well, it's a orangish yellow, and sometimes it'll have a red blush. It's not a big fruit, but it has a exciting flavor. But it has a little bit of high acid, and the blend of sugar and acid is very good.
When you open this fruit up, the pit clings to the flesh, right?
Yes, it does.
So what is the best way to cut it so that we don't completely destroy the piece of fruit while we're eating it?
I think just eat it out of your hand.
Yeah, is that the best way?
Yes, I do think that. You can cut it on the side of the pit and everything, but it's a handheld fruit.
Okay.
So that's the way I would eat it.
Me too. I know this is a short season, so what else is on the table right now that we can look forward to in the coming weeks?
We have Flavorosas, which is a pluot, and it's more plum than apricot, but it's red inside, and it's got a little bit of a Santa Rosa flavor without the tart skin. We're going to have Black Splendors coming up in about 2 weeks or so. They're red inside and just a shiny black on the outside. And when they're ripe, they are one of the most outstanding plums I have.
Oh, fantastic. Well, we can't wait for all of it. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
That was Bob Wiebe. Together with his wife, Susan, he is behind Juicy Fruit Farm up in Reedley, California. The Wednesday Santa Monica Farmers Market is the only market that they attend here in Southern California. A few early birds might be able to get those Flavorellas on Wednesday. Otherwise, we have a lot of plums and pluots to look forward to in the coming weeks. Macklin Kasnoff is here now. He is the partner and chef at Stir Crazy, a wine bar on Melrose that's serving seasonal small plates. It's the kind of place you might stumble into in Europe, but lucky for us, it's right here in LA. Hi, Macklin.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm good. So you've only been open for, what, a few months now?
We've just opened our doors. We're welcoming people in. We've been kind of playing around with the structure of the menu a lot, jumping into what's seasonal in the market and also trying to figure out what sort of dishes we can play around with that we can utilize all the produce that's available in California year-round as well.
So when I look at it on Instagram and in other people's photos, it seems like a lot of small plates. Is it a place that you would come in for dinner, or is it a place that you sort of get a snack and a drink on your way to dinner?
We really like to talk about it as sort of cafe culture. So the idea is that you can kind of utilize it in a lot of ways. You can definitely come in, eat a full meal, drink 3 or 4 bottles of wine with a big group of people, or you can come in and have a snack and just a glass. The menu kind of runs the gamut, and we have things like a sausage that we just put on the menu or a big celery salad, and those things can kind of function as almost a main course or a shared kind of larger plate, and then we have little snacks as well.
So what are you super excited about at the market this week?
We've been using the Valdivia Farms cherry tomatoes. They're kind of this perfect firm tomato that allows us to blanch them, and we peel back the skins and we marinate them in a kombu dashi with a bit of ginger and shiokoji, and it kind of is this little ohitashi pickled tomato moment that you can pick up from the skin of the tomato and pop it in your mouth, and it's just the perfect texture tomato to be able to do that with.
So how do you achieve peeling those individual tiny tomatoes? I imagine that's a lot of work.
It's a lot of work. Basically what we do is we'll put a slit in the bottom of each tomato and we'll blanch them in boiling water and then transfer them to an ice bath, and the skins will begin to kind of ripple around the edge of the slice, and we literally hand peel each one up kind of so it has a little handle.
Like a lollipop.
Exactly, just like a lollipop or like a banana, orange, whatever.
That's so cool. So what is the kitchen like there? It was a cafe before, right? Like a coffee shop?
It's kind of a Central Perk style 90s coffee shop that we gutted and did the best we could. I guess the story of the menu is partially that we have one induction burner and a combi oven, and that's all. And it's really hard to figure out what we can pick up. A lot of the food is very prep heavy. We get to infuse a lot of the flavor in the first 4 hours before everybody gets there and cook stuff really simply in a convection oven. So the finesse is in kind of how we build the dishes, which as I've put the menu together, I noticed that kind of, you know, relates to a lot of old school French cooking in a lot of ways, these long sauces. We do this carrot sauce for our carrot dish where we make a Bermonté. We juice carrots and reduce it and then basically make a Bermonté with carrot juice and season it with a Persian spice called Avdeya, espelette, vinegar, and white soy.
Describe a Bermonté.
A Bermonté is kind of the most basic of French sauces. Essentially, you're taking a liquid, a stock, wine, some sort of reduction, and you're emulsifying butter into it into a stable, somewhat thin sauce that I don't think is seen a lot these days because everybody is doing purees and all these things that are thicker and hold up on the plate. But there's something really delicious about having a buttery broth that you can dip bread into, and it, you know, feels a little indulgent and also not insanely so at the same time, so you can eat a lot of it.
Wow. Thank you so much, Macklin.
Thank you.
That was Macklin Kasnov. He is a partner and chef at Stir Crazy. It's a brand new wine bar, 6 weeks old, on Melrose in Hollywood. For The Market Report, I'm Jillian Ferguson.
If you missed any of today's show, listen at kcrw.com/goodfood or on KCRW's mobile app. You can also subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. My thanks to the Good Food team, Jillian Ferguson, Laurel Garcia, Elena Shatkin, Desmond Taylor, Nick Lamponi, and Hope Brush. And special thanks to Laura Kondarajan and Gary Masiha. I'm Evan Kleinman. For all of you grads and parents of grads, congratulations. I really hope you're celebrating with some delicious food. I'll be back next week with an all-new episode of Good Food.